Tonight on Agents of Cool, we talk about the Roger Moore not classic Bond film, The Man with the Golden Gun. Welcome to tonight's episode of The Agents of Cool. We have elected to go through the Bond films of Roger Moore. Sir Roger Moore. I love Roger. I do. It's like I feel a little embarrassed to admit this in public to people, but Roger's actually my favorite James Bond. I know I'm not supposed to say that, but he is.
It's like the Doctor. Your favorite James Bond is going to be Sean Connery or the first James Bond you saw.
Basically,
for me, the first James Bond I saw was Roger Moore.
I love Roger.
ABC TV edits, let's be fair, so there's... But still.
So we did Live and Let Die, and despite finding the film unbelievably racist by the standards of our day and age, it's still a pretty snappy little Bond picture, right?
Yeah, there's good bits in there.
But when we get to The Man with the Golden Gun, which was released only a year later, put into production relatively quickly to capitalize on the commercial and critical success of Live and Let Die, and, oh, holy Jesus, where do we even start with this thing? Our format for the show is we'll usually take the thing and then we'll walk you through the story of the thing, being funny and sarcastic and quippy and hopefully highly listenable on the way. But I don't think I can do that this time because going back through the entire story of this film makes me wish I was dead. I watched it with, my daughter wasn't so much watching it as she was in the room. And She was tolerating it. My daughter is 13. She is independent and intelligent, perceptive, witty, and she did not approve. We get to the scene with where Bond invades High Fat. Yes, the guy's name is High Fat. Invades the mountain redoubt of one High Fat. Encounters a Chinese girl in a swimming pool who identifies herself by the name Chu Mi. She invites him into the pool. Bond says, but I don't have any swimming trunks. And she says, that's okay. I don't either. And imagine explaining that to a 13-year-old girl in the year 2019. Because I really kind of couldn't.
You've shown her Goldfinger, right?
Nah, because that's the one where he rapes Pussy Galore Straight.
Okay,
I don't feel like explaining that either.
Okay, yeah, okay. So, all right. You've so far actually dodged having to explain these various bits and pieces.
I have made choices in which Bond movies I watch with my daughter in the room.
Have you done GoldenEye?
Yeah, I didn't think that was too bad.
So you didn't have to explain... Okay, how long's it been since you've seen GoldenEye?
Well, it's been a while.
Okay, so when you watch it, you're going to have to explain Xenia on a Top when you
killing
get to that
point. Killing people with her thighs?
Killing people with her thighs. That's not quite as bad.
No, it's not in the same ballpark. It is positively tame by comparison.
By comparison.
I'm just saying, some of the stuff that went right over the head
this next time. And then third nipple zone people were, and I quote, gross. What else do we have here? Oh, wow. So we're not...
Why did they keep making jokes about that third nipple, too?
How
many times did Bond say a word with tit in it?
A lot. He did that a lot. Okay, we were discussing before we began recording that a lot of this, the Scaramanga's secret island in this film, and how in the hell a hitman has a secret island with a solar energy power station.
Apparently it was Jesus. High Fats at some point.
Where in the hell does a hitman get a flying car? What was that thing? A Dodge? Was that like a Gremlin or something?
This is the key thing.
A Dodge Dart? With wings? I don't even know.
We're jumping a little bit ahead here, but okay. So we probably recap. Basically, Christopher Lee...
Okay, 1974, Christopher Lee, and freakishly enough, I just watched Dracula AD 1972 a couple of weeks ago. We're roughly in the period where Christopher Lee has been playing Dracula for some time and has grown good and damn sick of it. The Hammer films have been dropping in quality. He felt like the part wasn't giving him any challenge as an actor. He was sick and tired and disgusted. So Christopher Lee gets a call from his agent, you want to be in a Bond film? And he says, well, of course he wants to be in a Bond film. Of course he says
like
yes.
Like you do.
Ian Fleming was his cousin.
Yeah.
They were related. They golfed together. Christopher Lee approaches this movie with an extraordinary joie de vivre.
Yeah, so basically the movie essentially is Christopher Lee plays a hitman named Scaramanga.
Francisco Scaramanga.
And
father Cuban, mother English, raised in a circus until the age of 10, an accomplished trick shot artist, hired out as a hitman, recruited by the Soviets, not a single...
Overworked, underpaid, one relates.
Eventually went freelance, no existing pictures of him, the only identifying characteristic on record is a superfluous... nipple, an extra nipple.
The is, of course, the Latin for that.
The Latin term, which I don't remember because it didn't have the subtitles on for that
papilla
scene.
Papilla is what Bond said.
Superfluous papilla.
Yes.
An extra nipple, sir. So, okay, so Roger, notorious for having the sense of humor of a middle school boy, is basically making tit nipple jokes through the whole movie.
We're recapping the movie. Recapping the movie real quick so we don't have to go through the whole thing.
So this dude kills people for $1 million.
$1 million in 1974, hit. Which right. is...
$1 million a hit in 74.
$1 million a hit. He has a gun made of gold or plated with gold. With golden bullets, that only holds one because he only ever needs one. He's that good a shot.
Yep. And someone has delivered a golden bullet with 007's number on it to MI6's headquarters. They've confirmed Scaramanga's fingerprints are on it. They don't have a picture of him. They know he has an extra nipple. Nobody has a picture of him. Okay. So M gives Bond the option, well, you can resign if you want, or we're pulling off your current case involving some sort of missing solar energy scientist.
This turns out to be significant later.
1974, energy crisis. Right, they're attempting to be topical.
So Bond counterproposes, well, if I get Scaramanga first, though, that changes things. And M's like, well, of course. And so Bond goes to various locales trying to track down Scaramanga and starts working his way through a variety of plausible to implausible means to narrow down Scaramanga's suppliers for his custom ammunition. And then follows that person to the person that picks up the ammunition and gradually ends up facing off against Scaramanga, or so he thinks.
Well, it looks like Scaramanga just shoots this random bystander and he has what looks like a perfect shot on Bond. Then it turns out the random bystander was the solar energy guy that Bond was supposed to be finding before. And apparently he thereby, because we see Knick-Knack, the henchman who is played by Hervé Villechaize.
Oh, can I say his name?
Yeah.
Hervé Villechaize. Okay,
Of later, we think, Fantasy Island fame. Yeah, is, like, molesting the body right after it gets killed, and he takes the Solex Agitator.
The Solar MacGuffin.
Yes.
Yes.
It is, apparently allows for really efficient conversion of solar energy into electricity.
Right. So, after this, Bond gets picked up by the local MI6 staff in Hong Kong, and is taken to the little base there. Mm-hmm. M kind of, meets with M, and they have no idea what to do next, and Bond, well, we're a bit of a pickle. We don't have the Solex. The scientist we're trying to meet with is dead. Now what? Well, Bond has one possible lead, a businessman in Bangkok named Hai Fat.
Yes, you heard that right. Hai Fat.
Who apparently in an earlier version of the script did have a partner named Lo Fat, who was shorter.
Of course.
Oh, holy God.
So anyway, Bond gets the bright idea. We will go to Hai Fat. He'll pretend to be Scaramanga and try to,
because no one's ever seen Scaramanga.
There's no pictures of Scaramanga. So.
And at this point, Bond realizes Scaramanga can't possibly be after Bond because he could have killed me then and there. He had a perfect shot and he didn't. So Bond goes to High Fat's mountain villa, bungalow, whatever you want to call it, pretends to be Scaramanga.
With his Q branch made fake third nipple.
Right.
Oh, and wasn't that just Q's favorite day at work?
Yes. So High Fat invites him back for dinner. Bond walks out, does some stuff with his local contact, and comes back later. While that's going on, however, it turns out Scaramanga is also visiting High Fat. High Fat knows who Scaramanga is, knows that was James Bond, and makes arrangements to
take him to school.
Right. So Bond comes back, gets attacked by sumo wrestlers and her Villasheva, gets knocked out. They're going to kill him. High Fat tells him, take
him
to school.
You can't kill him on my property, apparently. Take him to school.
So we get a long, drawn-out kung fu sequence.
Because school is a kung fu school.
Right. They try to kill Bond.
Where children actually kill each other with swords.
Yes. There's a overly long kung fu fight, and then Bond escapes. There's another overly long kung fu fight, and then, God help us, there's a damn boat chase. Sheriff Pepper shows up.
He does.
Right.
A small child desperately attempting to sell Bond a wooden elephant for an inflated price somehow ends up in his boat.
They wrap that up. At this point, Bond's not sure what to do next. Then, literally into his arms, falls Scaramanga's mistress, who he had roughed up earlier to try to get where Scaramanga was going to be. And it turns out she is the one that sent the bullet with 007 on it to MI6, because she was trying to get
someone who could kill Scaramanga.
She wants to break up with Scaramanga, and of course you don't break up with somebody like Scaramanga, so you gotta have somebody kill him for you.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, at some point in this, Scaramanga, shortly after, I think, Bond escapes, Scaramanga kills High Fat and grabs the Solex, pretty much saying, well, I'm in charge now. Have his body put in the mausoleum. Because High Fat is getting ready to book it because he's pretty sure the jig is up. Because
it looked a lot like High Fat thought he was Scaramanga's boss.
Yes.
And Scaramanga maybe didn't see it that way.
It turns out that they did have some kind of partnership in whatever High Fat was building that was the solar energy thing. So I think the reason the hitman ends up with a James Bond villain lair by the end is that it's actually something High Fat put together. And he effectively inherits the company.
Right. So they make arrangements to... The mistress is going to get the Solex Agitator. That's the MacGuffin here.
It's very tiny. About the size of a cigarette case.
Yeah. From Scaramanga and meet Bond at this track. Bond goes there, sits there chatting with her, and realizes about... You know, she's not very talkative because she is, in point of fact, stone cold dead. Scaramanga has apparently put a bolt through her heart, killing her instantly without anybody noticing.
Slumping over.
Or anything. And Scaramanga sits down. He and Bond have a great little exchange there. Bond notices the MacGuffin is on the ground, contrives to pick it up and hand it off to...
Lieutenant Hip.
Yeah, his MI6 contact, who is posing as a peanut vendor.
Spelled H-I-P. Lieutenant Hip.
Right. He then hands it off to the other
Mary
local contact.
Goodnight, who is apparently a rookie agent that Bond knew 2 years ago. Suggested to be in a romantic sense.
Yes. So... Through a series of bad judgments on her part, she ends up getting stuck in the trunk of Scaramanga's car with the MacGuffin while trying to plant a tracking device on it. Car chase ensues. An amazing stunt ensues.
We'll get back to the stunt. The stunt is actually the high point of the movie.
J.W. Pepper is involved, so okay.
Stereotypical southern racist sheriff caricature, J.W. Pepper.
If you heard our last episode, you're pretty much
the same deal.
So, then... They make off with a car that turns into a jet plane with both Agent Goodnight and the MacGuffin.
But there's still a tracking device, and she has a walkie-talkie. So.
Right. So they are able to trace it to Chinese territorial waters. At this point, M is like, well, that's that. We can't really go in there. Bond's like, well, I can go in there off book. Bond flies a seaplane in there. He and Scaramanga have a wonderful series of exchange and basically a honest-to-God James Bond villain lair complete with a solar-powered death beam.
Oh, yes, that is the best part. The dude is using this agitator to actually make solar energy practical in 1974. Since the world's gripped in an energy crisis, he's going to auction the technology off to the highest bidder. And it turns out, just in case that wasn't bad enough, that the thing can also be used to make a death ray.
Right, and the idea is, okay, we'll give a complete monopoly to whoever bids for it, and... Bond says, well, you know, the various oil-producing states would probably buy it off of you just to keep it off the market. It's like, well, that thought had occurred to me. Christopher Lee is delightful, and it boils down to he would like to have a duel mano-a-mano with James Bond.
Looks like a classic pistol duel.
Right, and then, of course, Scaramanga pulls a trick, and all of a sudden he disappears when Bond turns around, so now Bond is stalking him through the island lair, including Scaramanga's little funhouse death trap. Now, at the beginning of the movie... The opening sequence was not James Bond on a mission. It was
Knick-Knack approaching Scaramanga on the beach on the island of Phuket. Phuket. Phuket.
That's its actual name. They did not make that up for the movie.
This is your key to arch your eyebrow. Scaramanga emerges from, well, Dracula. At that point, you're thinking it's Dracula. Dracula emerges from the ocean, right? There's a chick in the ocean. He has a drink, maybe eat some oysters. Tattoo from Fantasy Island has welcomed a well-known gangster actor, Rodney Thompson. No, Mark Thompson, I'm sorry. The character's name is Rodney. The actor's name is Mark Thompson. You've seen him as a gangster in every television show and movie you ever made. You know who he is. You love him. You love his face. You love his voice. He was a gangster in Star Wars, for God's sake. You know it was. And he walks up, and Knick-Knack has arranged this guy to come in here and try to kill Scaramanga. And he pursues Scaramanga into the villain lair. The lights go red, and they're shooting, and Knick-Knack, Hervé Villechaize tattoo.
Crazy funhouse maze that Knick-Knack can manipulate.
And he's taunting Dracula. I mean, Christopher Lee. I mean, Scaramanga. He's taunting this guy over the loudspeakers, and the lights are red. And then there's this duel to the death, and Scaramanga puts a neat little hole in the head of the gangster.
So this is some kind of game or training exercise that Scaramanga does that where he has to find his gun while this guy is trying to kill him. And apparently Knick-Knack actually gets something if the other person that he hires manages to kill.
Right, so it's kind of like Scaramanga. The thing with Inspector Clouseau where basically he's had he has paid his manservant to try to kill him whenever he comes home to keep him on his toes. Now, at the conclusion of this, there is a wax replica of James Bond in the little funhouse lair, and they get done, and Scaramanga looks a little wistfully at it and then goes... Bam, 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 and shoots all the fingers off the wax duplicate.
Off the wax duplicate.
Right. So Scaramanga has had an obsession with Bond from jump.
So Scaramanga also apparently follows Bond on Twitter. He's got a blog. He does Tumblr fan fiction.
He wasn't ever sent after Bond, but he's really been wanting to fight this guy. So the entire setup, from his point of view, is to get Bond into this funhouse maze with him.
Right. Do you want to read my fan fiction, Mr. Bond?
Bond gets one over on him by actually poses as the duplicate dummy, catches Scaramanga out, puts one through him, then is narrowly killed by Agent Goodnight, not being able to properly turn off the death beam controls. The island explodes, they escape in the little boat.
And Scaramanga's junk.
Yeah. And
they escape and scare Mangus.
Knick-Knack is hiding in the boat and tries to kill them while they're about to, you know, do the thing that James Bond and the girl do at the end.
Have been trying to do the whole flipping movie. Yes. He hasn't snogged Goodnight yet. Mm. All right.
So Bond puts him in some luggage and basically sails off into the closing credits. So that is basically the movie in a nutshell.
So,
But it's
we all had a mutual friend back in college named Susan. Susan, who may be one of our listeners, I hope so. She gets name-checked often enough. We were watching this back in the 90s, and she says, and like her whole theory about this movie is that the whole thing is basically completely out of alignment. They haven't found Roger's movie Bond yet. So they're writing scenes for Bond that Sean could play and not lose your sympathy. For example, roughing up poor Maude Adams to get information out of her. Sean could play that scene and not come off like a dick. Roger plays that scene.
Just the right kind of dick.
And comes off like a super dick. All right. So it's like, and he's smoking this cigar the whole picture. And like everything Roger does in this movie, he comes off like an asshole.
The only scene that really seemed off to me was where he is roughing up Scaramanga's mistress to get information.
I feel like most of the movie, Roger doesn't come off very well. Mm. But Christopher Lee, who is probably super happy to not be Dracula, walks onto the stage with a bounce in his step and a smile on his face and joy in his heart. He embraces the movie with the joie de vivre that one usually associates with the character of Bond. So it's like the guy you like is actually the villain, and the person you don't like is Bond. And I feel like the whole thing's just out of whack.
That scene aside, I don't think Roger seemed too off in that.
Roger also didn't like pushing the elephant kid into the
water. That was... Yeah, yeah,
another thing, Sean could do that. Get in the water, kid. Bam. And it's like you go, ha, ha, ha. Sean pushed him in the lake. Or whatever. Sean could do that, but Roger just comes off like a dick.
The big thing with this movie is the major Bond scenes, okay? The eyes... slit illuminated from the assassin as he aims his gun at the back of James Bond, and then bam, and somebody else falls dead. The dead body in the racetrack with everybody cheering and yelling and nobody noticing. The duel at the end, just the conversation between Scaramanga and Bond at the track. All of your major pieces are all here of a Bond movie. All the connecting bits and pieces that move you from cool scene to cool scene to cool scene. The bit with the arms manufacturer, the guy who makes Scaramanga's bullets, that works. That plays perfectly. But
Roger threatens to shoot his junk. That threatens to shoot his junk off. This guy hasn't done anything.
He makes bullets for killers.
Bond kills people.
The point is,
Lazar's a craftsman. He's charming. He comes off as charming. He comes off as intelligent, a wonderful dinner companion. And Roger threatens to shoot him in the dick. It's like, and that's not, that's a D move, Roger. It's a D move.
That one's funny. Roger also dunks a man in a wheelchair down a flipping smokestack.
But that was Blofeld who killed Bond's wife. And he's asking for that.
The thing is, that one.
And that was after Blofeld had tried to kill him with a helicopter. Lazar hasn't done anything. He hasn't done anything in this film to justify getting his dick shot off.
All Lazar has is information on the man that is trying to kill James Bond.
And in fact, the one thing we've seen him do in this movie was he's adapted a rifle for a hunter with special needs. That's cool. That's awesome. He's custom built a rifle you don't need fingers to pull a trigger on because some guy needs a custom rifle. He's done something super cool and helpful in this movie.
You realize that rifle
Bond
is probably...
Bond then uses that rifle
Bond then uses that rifle designed for a man with special needs to threaten to shoot a man's dick off.
Okay, that man with special needs was probably another hitman with special needs who's still playing the game.
We don't know that. We don't know who's getting the rifle.
You do not... Okay.
It's like Mission Impossible Fallout. You know why they don't kill Fallout? Not Fallout, Rogue Nation. You don't have the scene where Ethan has to kill the guy at the end of the movie because the guy at the end of the movie hasn't done anything. You haven't seen him do anything in the course of the movie to get killed for.
And
Lazar hasn't done anything in this movie to get his dick shot off.
And Roger doesn't shoot his dick off.
But he threatens to shoot his dick off.
Of course he does. That's how you get information out of people. You threaten
but it makes
them.
But it makes him seem like an asshole. Which is my whole point. Roger comes off like an asshole in this movie.
It is interesting. It's not the usual Roger Moore Bond style for getting information out of people, especially women, what he does to both Lazar and Andrea Anders.
What I'm saying is the only one to me that seemed off was the scene with Andrea Anders.
Okay.
The scene where he shows to shoot a guy's dick off
the bit
seems
with
off
Lazar
to me too.
Didn't strike me as off, but the overall point, back to the point I was trying to make.
The little boy in the water. It's like all the guy's doing is just trying to sell. He's some poor Southeast Asian kid trying to make 20 bucks.
Effectively saves Bond's life in the boat chase because Bond is like, I'll pay you 20,000 pounds if you'll make this boat go faster. And the kid just like
releases the gas. The kid helps.
Yeah.
And for his trouble, he's pushed in the water. It's like Roger's doing things to people in this movie that have done nothing in this movie to deserve what he does to them.
Bond always does things to people that don't deserve it. Anybody?
No. He does. People get what they deserve in Bond movies. Or Bond does things to people that they deserve to have done to them in Bond movies.
The people whose car got ran over by the tank in GoldenEye deserve to have a tank run over their car? James Bond raises insurance premiums everywhere he goes for innocent people.
Okay, let's split that here. GoldenEye, he runs over the cars with the tank. But number one, they're all Russian. Number two, they should have known better than to park a car in the way of a tank in the first place. He doesn't actually hurt anybody in that. And cars can be replaced. Lazar can't have his dick sewn back on if he gets it shot off.
Right, and again,
he used the fact that pulling the trigger with five fingers instead of three shoots an inch low to shoot a warning shot at Lazar's dick.
Yeah, but Lazar hasn't done anything to deserve that. And Roger comes off like an asshole in that scene. When he threatens to break Octopussy's arm.
That I agree.
When he pushes the kid in the water, he comes off like a complete asshole. He comes off. It's like Christopher Lee is the callous, cold-blooded murderer for hire, and he comes off with all the joie de vivre and the charm and the happiness. He kills High Fat. High Fat deserves it because High Fat is engaged in some kind of scheme to control world energy. Has actually tried to have Bond killed. High Fat deserves what he gets. And Christopher Lee does it with a smile and wit and charm. Roger doesn't have that in this movie. The guy who is the suave, charming, you know, James Bond, the fun guy, the guy you trust, the guy you like, comes off like an asshole the whole movie.
I don't think he's an asshole the entire movie. There are some scenes where I think he does. There are some scenes I think it's within the general level of Bond using force to get what he wants that we see in a Bond movie.
This is where we apparently disagree on this movie.
But the larger issue about this movie...
or Daniel Craig... or Timothy Dalton. So most of the Bonds, the more brutal Bonds, could have done those scenes. So it really is just a Roger thing.
There are things Roger can't do.
But the larger point I was making before we got off on this was, while you've got your classic James Bond scenes that I think do work, anytime when Roger and Christopher Lee are on the screen together, it's electric. There's just a sense of menace that Lee exudes, and Roger comes back at it just perfectly. It's great. And when he's trying to strategize, okay, how do I get this guy? How do I make the hunter the hunted in this? Those bits are great. It's all of the connecting tissues. How you get from scene A to scene B. Why the heck is Sheriff Waldo Pepper in this? Why do we need a 15-minute boat chase? Why do we need the superfluous kung fu fight? Why is possibly the one of the tensest moments in the movie is whether James Bond is going to get barbecued or not, because
Britt Eklund's ass is going to push the wrong button.
Yeah, it's because apparently, Goodnight can't deactivate the death ray.
Also, Goodnight is in a bikini the entire time.
Yeah, so those bits and pieces are even more problematic
right. by our standards.
That's the thing. All those bits and pieces that connect all of these really cool scenes with Christopher Lee and Roger Moore are the weak point in the movie.
Well, Britt Eklund.
There's a good James Bond movie in here, but... You kind of like, what was it, the one that we just... Oh, no, it was Quantum of Solace.
Which is still a better movie than this.
It's got all the stuff.
It's like Quantum of Solace. The individual bits and pieces look perfectly good in isolation, but they just don't quite gel.
Not a bad movie, but just doesn't gel.
Same thing here. There's lots of good bits and pieces of a good James Bond movie in here, but the way you get from scene A to scene B to scene C... doesn't really work, and in some cases kind of actively, I think, detracts from the enjoyment.
Now, I was talking to the kid, my 13-year-old daughter, a young woman of intelligence and wit and perception. Bond women are perceived in the popular culture, the popular media, as bimbos. I would argue that the majority, and I don't have the percentages in front of me, but I would argue that the majority of Bond women are not, in fact, bimbos. That the majority of Bond women are, in fact, while they are clearly in the film for Bond's sexual pleasure, are reasonably intelligent, tough, independent women. Britt Eklund, as Mary Goodnight, is not. And for some reason, I think when you say Bond girl to the man on the street, they think, even if they don't know the name of the character, the movie, the actress, this is the Bond girl they're thinking of.
I think Bond girl depends on who you're asking to and which Bond movie they're thinking of when they ask it. Because, obviously, the Bond girl in For Your Eyes Only...
She's
a completely different Bond girl than, say, the Bond girl from...
Quantum of Solace.
Or World Is Not Enough.
Or Casino Royale, or GoldenEye.
Or World Is Not Enough.
But what I'm saying is, it's like when you confront sort of the platonic ideal, the generic idea, the image, when you say Bond girl, quote-unquote, Mary Goodnight, even if you don't know her name, the movie, anything about her, this is the image you have of Bongo, not people like us, obviously, the person on the street, you know, the casual fan. The person that's maybe seen a couple of Bond movies and doesn't even know the titles. This is what I think this is the
far outlier.
But this is what people think of.
Very few people have seen every single James Bond movie from Jump.
Okay. Well, we have, but...
There's three of us. There's 7 billion other people on the face of the planet.
We're also the people taking a perfectly good Saturday afternoon to do a James Bond podcast.
It's Friday.
Is it Friday?
It's Friday.
Well, holy shit. We're doing this on a Friday. What's wrong with us?
Well, believe me, if this was Saturday at this point...
It's usually Saturday.
I'd be crying because I only got one day left.
It's usually Saturday.
But the thing is... Okay, but I think it depends. I think, yeah, there is the... And even within a Bond movie, there are different Bond girls, if you think about it.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not arguing any of that. I'm just saying that for some reason, this character and this characterization took over the public perception of those two words. I mean, we know, obviously, that there are lots of different Bond women of lots of different characters, lots of different personalities, lots of different... There's a huge spectrum of just, like, people within these films, but that this woman and this characterization has taken over the sort of platonic ideal in the public consciousness.
See, that's the thing. I think she's...
Which I find regrettable, and is another black mark against this movie.
Okay, I find her an outlier in that...
Of course we do. We've seen all the movies.
But that's the thing, though. This movie is 20-some-odd years old.
Almost 50 years old.
50 years old, sorry. This movie is 50-some-odd years old. I don't think
going to go take our geritol now.
I don't think this is the platonic ideal of the quote-unquote Bond girl in the popular conscious. There's been 20-some-odd movies since this.
But I bet you...
For some reason why we have this run in the early Moore movies and were there some a little bit earlier of the rather incompetent female rookie agent.
I think that may be a function of the time the movie was made, vice anything about, quote-unquote, the Bond girl. Even For Your Eyes Only, which was... When was that?
81.
81, so that's what...
Carol Bouquet.
So that what came after this one? Was that...
The next one was Spy
Who Loved Me, which is a female version of James Bond.
Major Amasova, played by Barbara Bach, and then you have Moonraker with...
I think they changed it from the books.
It wasn't the book. The book was Gayla Brand.
Right.
Gayla Brand, who, my understanding, actually served more as inspiration for Rosamund Pike's character in Die Another Day. So it wasn't Gayla Brand in the movie. I'm blanking on the actress and I'm blanking on the character's name, but then it was an American CIA agent in Moonraker, and then it was the half-Greek, half-British girl, Melina, played by Carol Bouquet in For Your Eyes Only, and then Maude Adams comes back in Octopussy as Octopussy, and boy, am I going to have a tough time explaining that name to my kid. And then
put it in the title of the movie, so they strangely didn't expect it to be universally taken as, is this a porno?
Well, yeah, we'll get to
the soundtrack in a minute.
We'll get to that one. And then, of course, you got Tanya Roberts in A View to a Kill, upon whom the blimp chases up.
I know why it was Lois Childs. I know why you're blanking on the name.
What was it?
That was Dr. Holly Goodhead.
Dr. Holly Goodhead.
The other one, besides Mary Goodnight, yes.
Goodhead, which means she's got a good head on her shoulders and is a highly intelligent person.
That's not what I was thinking.
Well, there's more than one way to interpret that name.
Right, and that's why it's a double entendre. But the point is, but I think some of this is the run here has to do with who's writing the scripts and who...
Yeah, that's what I'm going to tell the 13-year-old when we watch Moonraker.
Maybe
we're not going to watch Moonraker. Maybe that just saves me some hassle.
Moonraker...
And maybe it saves me 2.5 hours of, God... Gross.
How old is your daughter at this point?
She's 13.
So I'm going to bet you can basically put...
Like any given 2.5 hours.
Drop anything in the DVD player, hit go. You're going to get...
No, actually, she's not like that. You know she's not like that. But except for this, where it's like, chew me.
I don't blame her for this.
Actually, I just double checked it, and the flying car in this movie is apparently an AMC Matador. For a while there, I would have sworn it was a Pinto, and I thought, who in the hell builds a flying Pinto? But it was an AMC Matador, and she takes a look at this thing taken off in this picture, and she says, and I quote, oh dear. It's like, oh my God, why the hell does a hitman have a flying AMC?
Because he's not the hitman, he's the supervillain. He's the Bond villain in the movie.
It's a flying car. He doesn't need a flying car.
I do wonder why they did. I think Kenneth pointed this out, Ray's brother who watched it with us. He could have just transferred from the car to a plane, but instead he pulls into a barn and gets wings and an engine attached to his freaking car.
The thing about this movie...
Because it's not a flying car like it sprouts wings or something.
It bolts to the top.
Yeah. They essentially bolted an airplane on top of this car.
And off it flies. So
and it can still fly. It's got a car. Entire car hanging off the bottom.
There's nothing wrong. I mean, okay. There are any number of flying car vehicles that use that exact same model. It is actually perfectly feasible to do that. You're not doing supersonic. Mm-hmm. Again, look at like a seaplane. Look at any of your... you know, it's fairly blocky, but it's not going... gangbusters.
But I mean, it just looks very much, which I think is the whole joke with J.W. Pepper, because he's wondering whether the Asian people, but I did Asian people have not seen an airplane before, that they're all just staring at it. But it's literally a car, like some guy's Pontiac or something.
AMC, I just checked. Yeah, AMC was, Matador.
Yeah, that's perfectly, again, AMC was the sponsor, so it's like, well, what are we going to do
here? Yeah, the okay, other cars.
Lots and lots of product placement in this movie, Nikon.
But we should talk about this other car.
But we'll get to the other car, because there are...
There's one really one redeeming moment in this movie.
There's a couple. The conversation at the racetrack is electric.
My wife complained about the theme song. She couldn't get the theme song out of her head.
The theme song isn't terrible. One of the best. Yeah.
The man with the golden gun.
So this is okay. So
it's one of the overly explanatory ones.
In a nutshell, the problem with this movie
comes just before he kills.
Well, that's literally true, apparently, because Anders actually says they apparently only have sex right before he's about to kill somebody.
Oh, God.
The essential problem with the theme song here, and the credits, is it's trying too damn hard to be Goldfinger. They're trying too hard across the board with this movie.
The essential problem with the theme song is that it begins and does not end soon enough. This is like the one everybody's heard. Like, the man in the street has probably heard this song.
I've never heard this song before.
You've never heard this song before? Actually, nope. I take it back. I think most people have probably heard the Guns N' Roses version of Live and Let Die.
Yeah,
that's probably the one.
That is probably the...
Without even knowing where it comes from.
Live and Let Die, For Your Eyes Only, maybe even the Goldfinger song are like known in beyond just their theme song.
This one is imminently forgettable, thank God. It's terrible.
Apparently, but not for my wife. Apparently, she can't get it out of her head.
Go play Goldfinger, and you'll be fine.
Well, no, and because she knows about the part where he rapes Pussy Galore straight, and then I got to talk about for 2 hours.
No, I just mean the song. There's got to be some other earbud. The thing is,
actually, I've got the surefire cure to get any song in the world out of your head.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The Curly Shuffle. The cure might be as bad as the disease.
I use the Space Garrett song from Across Frontier.
Ah, yes.
That one's a
get up and dance and do the curly shuffle. Guaranteed to get any song in the world out of your head.
Okay.
Cure's worse than the disease, but whatever.
All right. Dear listeners, at this point, you probably realize there isn't a lot to not like about this movie. Now, I've maintained there are bits in this movie to like. To wit, Christopher Lee is absolutely electric and lights up the screen everywhere he is.
It's hard not to like Christopher Lee. Yeah. Count Dooku, Saruman, Dracula, Scaramanga, and character parts throughout, horror, science fiction, drama, police pictures. Check out his IMDb page. Read up on the guy's background. He comes from genuine nobility. He's got the dude is extraordinary. He did heavy metal albums in his late 80s. No kidding.
He was in the SOE and literally killed people.
Yes.
So
there's a story.
Bad people.
There's a story that I don't think is anecdotal, where he's on the set of Lord of the Rings and Peter Jackson is trying to get a sound effect right, and he walks up to Peter Jackson and says, "That's not what the sound of a knife in a human body is, Peter," or words to that effect. Right.
It's when his character Saruman gets stabbed in the back. He's apparently supposed to make some kind of noise, and he's like, "That's not what men who have just been stabbed in the back sound like."
Peter.
And then allegedly, so the story goes is like, "Well, how do you know that, Sir Christopher?" And he's like, "Can you keep a secret?" And Peter Jackson, wide-eyed, says, "Yes, yes, I can." He's like, "So can I."
Yeah, there you go.
And then he walks off. So,
actually, Roger Moore had a good quote, too. Someone asked him if he did his own stunts, and he said yes, and Roger says he also does his own lying. So I like that, too. I love Roger. I love Roger's Bond movies. The next one up in the cycle is going to be genuinely one of the greats. But I can't tolerate this movie.
But there are bits. So we're talking, though, about the bits. I think at this point we've established, as we said to the dear listeners a few moments ago, the parts we didn't like. There are a few parts that are worth at least fast-forwarding to. Anything where Christopher Lee and Roger Moore are on the same screen together are great. Because the key thing to remember about this is, Scaramanga structurally isn't just the hitman, which is normally traditionally the henchman role. He's the supervillain. He's the Joker. He is the Joker to Bond's Batman. He is, frankly, I think, a better dark mirror of James Bond than what's his face from Skyfall
or Alec Trevelyan.
Yeah. I will stand by that.
Which is not to run down Alec Trevelyan. But if we're talking Dark Mirror, Christopher Lee, Trump, Sean Bean, sorry.
You're talking about Silva from Skyfall.
Yeah.
As Dark Mirror, yeah, he probably Trump Silva too.
Which is not
to run down Silva at all or Alec Trevelyan. But Christopher Lee, sorry.
So, I mean, and right at the end, as they're walking around the island base and where you would normally get the little tour of the villain's plan, And there's bits and pieces where he's like, it does some sort of thing with science. And Bond's like, oh, it's liquid helium. And it's like, oh, yes, you know much more about it than I do. And then here's this next little bit here. So it's like, he's just very happy to be there. He has this wonderful little plan, this wonderful lair. There's going to be a wonderful lunch later. And then we are going to try to kill each other. Isn't this going to be great, merry fun? And it's, he sells it perfectly.
Has anyone seen...
He didn't build the base, so he doesn't actually know how the science works.
Well, has anyone here seen John Wick 3 Parabellum?
Yeah.
The scene where he's having the fight, was it Mark Duskoskos?
Oh, yeah. And the guy's just a fanboy.
And the guy's like, his guy's like a John Wick fanboy. It reminded me a little bit of the thing in John Wick reminds me a little bit of the Scaramanga Bond thing. Well, I'm such a fan. This is going to be a great fight.
The bit at the racetrack where essentially, you know, I'd never expected to meet you. This is actually, I am very, you know, grateful for my former mistress for making our paths cross. And Bond's like, interesting way of showing your gratitude. You know, she's sitting there stone cold dead. This is just, I never thought we'd actually get to meet. This is actually quite exciting for me. Hopefully our paths will never cross again. I intend to recover the Solex at some point, and, you know, they go on their merry way. And he is perfectly charming and polite and absolutely chillingly menacing all in the same scene,
which is
all with the same sentences, and it's great. So anytime it's worth it for just fast-forwarding the scenes where Christopher Lee and Roger Moore are talking, those are great.
We get his superlatively weird circus origin story about when he first learned that killing humans was what he really loved.
Yes, and that was, again, it's perfect. He is absolutely just a perfect, perfect, perfect villain. Any of that stuff's good. There is probably the greatest stunts in the history of actual, honest to God, stunts where people can die, as opposed to stunts where, oops, I may have messed up the green screen.
I looked a little bit on the extras about this. This is inarguably one of the greatest stunts in the history of Bond films, which makes it one of the greatest stunts in the history of stunts. And that's some really serious competition. There's a scene where Bond and Sheriff J.W. Pepper are in a stolen AMC Pace. I think it's an AMC Pace.
It's an AMC Astro.
It's an Astro? AMC Astro. There's a bridge, a broken bridge with a huge hunk out of the middle that is twisted into a spiral. And then Sheriff Pepper looks at Bond and says, "You're not gonna." And he says, "I sure am, boy." And proceeds to jump the car, spin the car, jump in, as the car spins from one broken half of the bridge to the other. And they do this in one take.
In a perfect corkscrew. So it just spirals up around, and it is beautiful. Now, dear listener, when you watch this screen, when Roger Moore says, "I sure am," you need to pick up the remote control on your TV, you need to press the mute button, and watch in beautiful silence as a car does a thing that, if anything was off a little bit here, if it made contact at the wrong point, if the timing was the least bit off, if the driver was
had
the speed out of too fast or too slow, this is not going to work, and someone's going to have a terrible, terrible day.
They had rescue people surrounding, just out of range of the camera. They had divers suited up and in the water under the bridge to get the driver out of the car, because the driver of the car was belted in, and they had, like, safety gear, and if this goes bad, he's in the water, and you got to get him out. They got divers in the water. They got a crane handy to lift the car out of the water if it comes to that.
They did 1970s-era computer modeling to make sure this would actually work.
I checked the extras. They used a computer, also used by the National Highway Safety Bureau for accident reconstruction. The people who run this computer were a division of Cornell University.
Calspan.
Yeah, and they modeled this whole thing. Got the numbers perfect.
The car was specially reconstructed. The driver was moved to the middle to, as I understand, to get the
center
of gravity, just so.
The driver, was whose name was Bumps Willard, by the way. Lauren Bumps Willard. And he's lying on his stomach in the car. He's working the gas and the brakes with his feet. The car has been widened by just about, they cut it in half and widened it by just about 2 inches. The level of effort for this one single take of this one spectacular jump. And in the film, it's perfect, except,
and this is why, dear listener, is why I said you want to hit the mute button.
And this is kind of my point about this movie. Even this movie won't let you have good things. This movie is why you can't have good things. This is why you can't have nice things, because they put a slide whistle over this jump. And then you got to look at J.W. Pepper's fat ass rolling around inside the car. This movie is why you can't have nice things. The more I get worked up about it, there was a time way back in the late 80s and the early 90s, there's a series of three films in the early 70s. There's Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, and Man with the Golden Gun. They are all three of them, to my eternal shock and horror, directed by Guy Hamilton. Guy Hamilton is the same guy that directed Goldfinger. Goldfinger, arguably the platonic ideal James Bond movie. I literally could not watch these three films for years and years and years because And I'm not lying. I know this sounds crazy. I literally experienced physiological side effects watching these movies. I would run a fever. I would feel nauseous. I literally could not physically watch these movies. They made me physically feel bad.
Seriously?
I'm not kidding.
This is not a syndrome that Ray and I have experienced.
No.
I was younger when this happened. These films made me feel so depressed and weird. I avoided them for years and years and years. And then, like, Roger's dead, so there's like never going to be another Roger Moore James Bond movie, so you got to kind of let all like what you got, right? So I can watch them anymore without feeling physiological side effects. And I know that sounds crazy. I'm not making it up. But how the guy that made Goldfinger would ever allow a slide whistle to be put over this jump is utterly beyond me.
Do you have the... I read that there was a Tom Mankiewicz script of this that they ended up not using that really played up the dark mirror thing between Bond and Scaramanga.
According to the extras, It started out Tom Mankiewicz did a draft. Tom Mankiewicz is the guy that wrote more or less Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, Man with the Golden Gun, and then uncredited on Spy and Moonraker, right? He was also the guy that kind of pulled together Superman the movie for Richard Donner. He was going to write the first Tough and Serious Batman movie in the early 80s, although his script was not used in the end. That Batman script is on the internet if you want to look for it, and I recommend it. It's not really what we're used to, but it could have been a good movie in the right hands in those days. And if you watch him on the extras and all these DVDs, he's a wonderful, charming Rick on tour. He wrote the first draft of this. He felt like he wasn't giving Cubby his best. Shock. And then stepped away, and then longtime Bond writer Richard Maybaum steps in and does a draft, and then they get Tom Mankiewicz back to do a rewrite of Maybaum's rewrite of his script. And they do make a reference in some of these extras to the dark mirror qualities of Scaramanga, but that doesn't come out, I think, enough in the movie.
There's bits and pieces, and those are, I think, the good bits. Beyond that, though, kind of a slog.
It's like the whole thing. We're all kind of mid to late 40s here, and we remember very clearly the movies of the early 1970s, which seem to have a vaguely beige / avocado sheen of sleaze smeared over them. The way the film stocks early 70s all look just kind of... It's like it's in the film stock, man. It's like there's something depressing in the stock.
Well, the thing about this is, I mean, you look about it, you go to foreign lands, you go to exotic places, but they go to a casino, but it's kind of more... Well, frankly, it's probably more like
seedy.
Casinos
very
are
in... Very pro forma. Yeah.
It's kind of seedy.
Yeah, but it's like it's loud and people are yelling and it's like if you go to a casino, like you are go to a casino and it's basically...
Yeah, it's not lap of luxury kind of stuff.
Yeah,
the bottoms up club.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, explain that to your 13-year-old kids.
Which has a giant heart-shaped butt on the logo.
And then it cuts to a shot of some girl's butt as she's like topless with her hair covering her chest. And it's like, oh my God, Mary, this I'm talking to my kid. This was just another time. It was another time. There were different rules, different expectations.
But that's the thing. I think you could have done this exact same movie with that script and just changed some of the locations to ones that were less
skeevy is a good word.
And, you know, improve our estimation of the movie tenfold. Because
you're in Hong Kong and Macau. There are fun, visual, poppy places to go.
That's what I'm saying. Guy Hamilton made this movie.
Okay, compare the casino scene. Compare the casino scene here and with, like...
GoldenEye. Or even God Help Us, Never Say Never Again.
Compared to the golf outings in Moonraker.
Yeah.
Okay,
compared to the golf scenes in Caddyshack.
Comparing it to like GoldenEye, which is pretty much, mission must succeed. We have to make the best James Bond movie ever, or there will never be another James Bond movie again. This is either going to be the best James Bond movie ever made, or it'll be the last James Bond movie ever made. So they pulled out all the stops.
Yeah.
We're operating on, probably a larger budget, but they could have made, there are any number of cool casinos in Hong Kong or Macau or what they could have gone to. They could have shot it and framed it entirely differently. And so it's like the hotel he stays at, uses Rolls Royces for flipping, for
courtesy
the
cars.
Airport shuttle. Yeah. So
it's like, we need you to follow, we need you to trace a green Rolls Royce. And Goodnight's like, you're aware that this hotel uses green Rolls, like, we can trace it to this hotel easily enough because they use the green Rolls Royces as their cars.
That's the one time Goodnight, that's like, maybe they're, kind of playing up the rookie agent thing, and she's actually knows what she's doing, but then they undercut that left and right. And I think that, they could have done a couple things to eliminate that, and that would have probably not been out of place. I think would have just made it a better movie and felt like what I think of as a James Bond movie. When James Bond, dresses up in a tuxedo to go to a casino, you want it to look stylish.
In all fairness, he's in a white dinner jacket in one scene, and he looks really cool. Yeah, that always works. The white dinner jacket on Roger.
Roger's wardrobe is spectacular throughout, other than the pajamas at the Kung Fu school.
But he does
his best in those.
But Scaramanga at the end of the movie with that like blue short sleeve grandpa shirt he's got on, he looks like Knick Knack picked that up on a sale at Penny's.
He looks great though. He's on vacation. He looks. I mean, he's toned. He's tanned.
He has his own tropical island.
He has his own tropical. You can pick up a Nehru jacket somewhere, dude. Make an effort, or at least wear your white linen, Mister. Oh my God. What is it with knick-knack and guys in white linen suits?
Well, no, that's the another thing Kenneth pointed out is that it should have been knick-knack spotting the seaplane so that he could have said the line.
Except they didn't do that yet.
Right.
It's like Hervé Villechaize's entire career is on isolated tropical islands with men in white linen suits. His entire career.
This may be why he
killed himself.
But that's the thing, though. I think Chris Reed looks great in this movie throughout. I mean, he's enjoying himself.
Looks great.
He's on a tropical vacation. He's about to make a gazillion dollars, completely upsetting the world economy.
And he gets to kill the one guy he's always dreamed about killing.
And lunch is this absolutely marvelous, this marvelous
delicious
thing.
Delicious fried mushrooms.
And this wonderful thing from
his personal cordon bleu chef.
And it's like he's got a coked out blonde girl in a bikini there, because she's got to be coked out, seriously.
The thing. I mean, he actually has one or two cool gadgets in the movie. He has the cool little gun he can assemble out of basic, the gold-plated cigarette case and the other stuff, and the lighter and his pin. He's got the flying car. It's a 70s flying car, but still, 70s. I think that's because it's a 70s car.
There were other cars in the 70s besides the AMC Matador.
AMC got the bid.
The only thing Bond gets from Cuba is his nipple.
Pretty much.
It's a stick of nipple.
And the only thing poor Q does in this movie is give Bond a fake nipple. It's like, oh my God.
I think he designed the homing devices technically, but that's the thing.
Between his first and second trips to see High Fat, he takes the nipple off and throws it into the woods.
I think second trip to see High Fat is going to be shirtless.
What did Q do? What's Q's assistant? Smithers? Did he have to get Smithers in there? Smithers, come here. And he slaps plaster on Smithers' nipple. I have to cast your nipple, Smithers. It's like it slaps a little plaster on there, rips it off. Gah! Q's job in this movie is to cast a man's nipple.
But that's the Scaramanga. Scaramanga gets to be cool and gets to do all the cool stuff. He has the cool gadgets.
Which is why the movie's miscalibrated. Yeah. Bond is supposed to do all that.
Scaramanga has the pre-title sequence, which I actually love, but is upended from most every other James Bond.
That's your clue right from jump. There is something out of whack with this movie. They need that to sell the bullet.
The funhouse and the bullet.
Because you can't just introduce that smack in the middle. Right. And honestly, you probably think, oh, this is the guy that obviously this guy is being set up by his treacherous little midget servant, and then something's going to happen here, and maybe James Bond is going to save the day.
Because it's just as much of a contest that could kill you for Scaramanga as it is for the gangster.
Right, but that's the thing. You don't initially know. Mm-hmm. You think, and all of a sudden the funhouse goes off and you start yelling. It's like, is this a double cross? What's going on? Oh, they're both complete sociopaths. But
why the hell is J.W. Pepper in freaking Bangkok?
Every once in a while, presumably he and his wife are just on vacation.
You see, what I want to do is
he hates Asian people, so I'm not sure why he's there.
It's like we can't even have a little.
His wife wants a wooden elephant, damn it.
I can't watch a little vehicular mayhem without him calling these people pointy heads out the window of the AMC.
I mean, there are much worse things he could have been calling.
Well, that's true, but it's still offensive. What I want to do is get a T-shirt made. J.W. Pepper 1974 World Tour.
The thing is, even the car car chase didn't even...
Bangkok, South Africa, maybe Mumbai.
The boat chase I felt was overly long. I thought, oh my God, they're in a boat again. Oh God, there's J.W. Pepper. And I started having flashbacks to... Okay, the car chase was...
It's the fact that in order to even have a boat chase, Bond's ride just drives away without him.
That's the other point. Yeah, the car chase...
His sidekick leaves him. And I don't blame him.
The sidekick with the two schoolgirl nieces, who thankfully turn out to be kung fu experts because they're Chinese, presumably.
Now, remember, this is a movie, and all Asian people in movie are kung fu experts.
Right. No, I did for one other cool thing. The secret MI6 observation post in the wreckage of the QE2.
That's awesome.
It's in the wreckage of an ocean liner that's, like a 45-degree angle. So they're using the rooms and such, but they've had to build steps at, like, a 45-degree angle, and, like, the tables and such and everything is all cockeyed, which really, I think, underscores the whole movie's out of whack.
Yeah, it underscores the theme. The whole movie's out of whack.
That little detail I really like.
They mentioned that it crashed or capsized in 1971, so presumably that was a recent historical event that actually happened.
Yeah, so I like that a little bit. I thought that was just one of those neat little, okay, you've got this this listing post and this exotic location, and of course, being British
in the hulk of a cruise ship in Hong Kong Harbor.
Perfectly matter of fact about it and such. I like that little detail.
Like, it's the one place they can go that the Americans and the Chinese
them.
Is gonna
yeah nobody's gonna bugging them and all, I think also like also given what you know also given real estate prices in Hong Kong, this is really much more affordable.
It is really
though. At that point, didn't they own Hong Kong?
Well, yes, but it's all the British government would still have to basically pay somebody to rent the space out.
So well, yeah.
It's still, it's a bit of a joke. I mean, it's a halfway capsized ocean liner.
Right.
So they're probably not paying all that much for it.
Now, on the subject of poor Christopher Lee, when Bond actually shoots him, he looks disappointed. He doesn't look sad or pained. He just looks, aw, thump. He's a little disappointed.
I think he kind of wants one of these guys to actually put up a good fight.
Oh, well, Bond put up the best fight.
Yeah, and he knew from the sounds that Bond had lost his weapon, which had more bullets than Scaramanga's one. So now he's one to zip, he thinks. Except that all of the figures in the maze have real guns. But yeah, it's neat that you go up behind what's supposed to be the Bond wax dummy, and you notice, wait, it's still got a full hand.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't have the fingers shot off.
Yeah, and then...
So much like... And it, of course, that echoes back at High Fats when his bizarre naked butt cheek sumo statues were real dudes.
Interesting. One thing I do like is also, of course, the Bond wax figure, whatever it is in the shooting pose from the opening credits.
Yeah.
So
Scaramanga's watched the other movies.
Yeah, pretty much.
Which is good to know. He's a Bond fan. I like that.
Yeah. Well, but that's, I mean, so there are little bits and pieces in this movie that are neat and good and cool,
but
you gotta slog through a bunch of connecting tissue that just is not all that.
The cowboy dummy is also supposed to be Roger Moore with a handlebar mustache, though it's actually played by his stunt double.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
I will say this, if you have the DVDs, there are the set of DVDs I have great behind the scenes, all narrated by Patrick McNee, that are wonderful. And this, the Man with the Golden Gun DVD has a wonderful behind the scenes about, it's a retrospective of all the stunt players and all the stunts and all the movies to that point, which I strongly recommend. So the DVD is worth having just for the extras, honestly. This was actually Fleming's last Bond novel published posthumously. There are rumors that Fleming didn't even actually finish the book, that the book that we have was actually kind of polished and finished by his agent, but I don't know if that's true.
I've read that as well, that it wasn't completed, they didn't have everything. I don't know if they even had a completed book to go off of, if that would help. I mean, the overall plot is kind of cool. There's the world's greatest hitman, and MI6 thinks James Bond, he's trying to kill James Bond, but it turns out that his mistress is trying to make MI6 think that, so to point Bond at the world's greatest hitman.
The setup is neat, and the casting of the villain is great.
It's just the execution, for most of it, just doesn't really live up to it.
And I'm not angry about it. You know, this was something
you were
like...
You were nauseous about it at one point.
I was nauseous about it, but, you know, it's like nobody ever sets out to make a movie that sucks, much less the Bond people. This, it just didn't work out. I mean, this was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. This was the ninth movie. Ninth movie in about 12 years? Maybe you're just out of gas.
I mean, and that's all right. It didn't do as well as the others at the time. So it's not just us in hindsight saying
I do remember reading a review of this film suggesting that maybe the whole thing was out of gas. See what I did there with the energy crisis metaphor? it's suggesting maybe the whole thing was maybe out of gas, which obviously it wasn't. As I recall, this was the last film co-produced by Albert R. Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman. Harry Saltzman thought they were out of gas at this point, too, sold off his interest in Bond to the studio without consulting Cubby, and I don't think Cubby ever forgave him for it, because after this, he was stuck with the studio forever and ever, which has led to lots of grief and shenanigans over the years.
As we all know, studio involvement always makes movies better.
Didn't the studio insist on Denise Richards in The World Is Not Enough? I think they did.
It wouldn't surprise me.
I think they did.
She was like the it actress in a bunch of stuff at that time.
And it's like, Christmas Jones, the nuclear physicist, played by Denise Richards. Wow, that's problematic, too.
I thought Christmas only comes once a year.
Oh, God. So, in the end, I mean, it's a Bond film, and we like it kind of because it's a Bond film, but is this a good movie? I am kind of happy to be through Man with the Golden Gun. I may not ever watch this movie again. Did I share my J.W. Pepper theory last time?
What is your J.W. Pepper theory?
Okay, you have racist Southern Sheriff J.W. Pepper in Live and Let Die.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you did.
You have racist Sheriff J.W. Pepper in Man with the Golden Gun. Same actor plays a Southern Sheriff in Superman 2. Mm-hmm. That character in Superman 2 is not identified by name. Mm-hmm. So in my head, the Roger Moore Bond films and the Christopher Reeve Superman films all take place in the same world. Not least because they have, particularly the good late 70s Roger Moore films and the Superman films, have significant production personnel in common, like Derek Meddings, the special effects genius, and they just feel of a piece to me, and there is some narrative linkage there in the person of Clifton James. So that's my headcanon, and you can't tell me I'm wrong.
Now, one thing about this one is we commented when we looked at Live and Let Die, you know, they're trying to do heroin and organized crime and such. And
yeah.
Okay. This one, okay, where they're trying to do the energy crisis, you know, right until the end there, okay, you do get like a gleaming stainless steel base, you know,
which was conspicuously not designed by Ken Adam. And it's disappointing to me.
It's nice. The wine cellar's good. I give it 4 stars, 5 stars. But so you've got these
1.5 stars on Yelp would not blow up again.
But, I mean, this is a fairly straightforward two assassins trying to kill each other kind of movie, okay? But that didn't do well. So the next one we get is The Spy Who Loved Me, which is full-blown super tankers stealing nuclear submarines trying to set off Armageddon kind of stuff. And then we get Moonraker.
Going to space.
Right. We swing from, we're trying to do these sort of plausible, slightly bonded up espionage plots. And like, okay, screw it. Full-blown supervillains with submersible cities.
I mean, this one, you do have that basic assassin versus assassin thing, which I thought was going to be the whole movie. And all of a sudden, we get basically a freaking volcano lair.
Yeah, right at the end.
So and I'm like, in a way, we just stapled an entire... And the guy not only is trying to corner the market of energy, but he has a death ray.
Yeah.
In a way, this movie kind of represents the two poles that Bond movies fluctuate between, as we see in this movie, sometimes even within the same movie. I think Michael Wilson once said, they're always trying to do From Russia with Love, but they end up doing Spy Who Loved Me. That they're always trying to get back to the Fleming, the kind of more human scale kind of espionage, the tougher stories, but they always end up going with, fuck it, volcano lair.
Well, the thing is, though, if you think about it, even Fleming, within the scope of the 50s, kind of did that. You started out with, okay, Moonraker, we think somebody's trying to sabotage the British Moonraker project.
Or Casino Royale, we go earlier than that.
Well, I think Moonraker's, I think, the better example. Okay. Because he starts out, okay, in the book, Bond's assigned to the Moonraker project, which is a British rocket program. Because someone's trying to sabotage the project. And as he gets deeper and deeper, what it turns out is actually everybody on the project are actually unreformed Nazi ballistic missile scientists, and they're going to use the Moonraker rocket they have fooled the British government into funding to destroying, like, London or the West or NATO in general. So it's like, you know, it starts out, okay, somebody's trying to steal rocket secrets, which is bad, and it turns out, no, someone's trying to use the rocket to wipe out Europe. So
It does grow in scale, yes.
Right, true. But that's the thing, you know.
Now, the movie version is like we're trying to breed the master race on the moon.
I mean, a really good Bond movie starts out, we have this one little anomaly, okay? This one little thing here, Bond either gets curious about or they would want to just check on this one little thing. This guy didn't report it. And gradually starts peeling back, and it turns out it's not what you think it is. It's this gigantic epics plot, you know.
Bond, our man in Jamaica had cornflakes instead of Rice Krispies for breakfast this morning. We'd like you to look into it, please. Right. Absolutely, sir.
2 hours later, basically.
Holy Jesus, it's dinosaurs on the moon.
Right. And there's a place for, you know,
Now I want to see that, Bond. Unironically, I want to see that movie.
That's the thing. We kind of want that where you gradually, you peel things back and it gets... You go further in front of the rabbit hole and the conspiracy is bigger and bigger and the villain's plans are bigger and bigger and crazier, and you want that. There is a middle ground. If you go too far, you get Moonraker, which is just ridiculous. If you try to, we're going to do super grounded, you get, you know,
Quantum, maybe?
Quantum couldn't figure out what it wanted to be. Quantum wanted to be super grounded, but also wanted to have the gigantic explosions and the crazy exotic locales.
Now, I can't look at one of the more super grounded Bond movies. Well, maybe License to Kill was a little flat.
Well, like, I like the ones that do it right.
For Your Eyes Only is perfectly grounded.
Oh, yeah.
But it still has exotic locales. Yeah. And that is, for me, in many ways, the perfect James Bond movie. Certainly the perfect Roger Moore movie.
Oh, yeah.
We've got this thing we need to recover, and oops, somebody else has recovered it, and we need to get that back. Mm. You still get some cool exotic locales, but you don't get, like, full-blown moon base or whatnot. Mm. You don't get death beams. Mm. But you still have a really cool, you know, the really cool assault on the mountaintop monastery and all that stuff. So I think it really, that one works just fine. GoldenEye has, like, freaking death satellites and, like, a giant radio telescope, you know, hidden under a lake in Cuba
Except the radio telescope is a real thing.
Oh, yeah, but it's not in Cuba, though.
Okay, it's not in Cuba.
They use that for the shooting, but basically, so you've got...
But I feel like GoldenEye is just about the perfect Bond movie.
Oh, yeah, GoldenEye shifts that window a bit, and it is able to do that and not become... It doesn't become Die Another Day. Mm-hmm. It doesn't become Moonraker.
I mean, they definitely went, if we're going to save the James Bond franchise, we got to go big James Bond. Whereas then, after the Pierce Brosnan series, when they started up the Daniel Craig series after a big gap, they were like, okay, we're going to go very grounded, brutal James Bond.
Yeah. Straight back to Fleming.
Yeah, and I think that was a good choice.
And finally make the first one, which we've never actually had the rights to do.
Now, weirdly, in a couple of podcasts from now, I'm going to be the one sitting here telling you how great I think Moonraker is. Mm. because I unironically love Moonraker.
Moonraker is super entertaining. Moonraker is great fun to watch.
I know what people say about Moonraker. I do, but I don't care. Again,
I'll probably like it because my standards are apparently lower than everyone else's.
I don't dislike watching Moonraker. Moonraker is great and super entertaining.
I don't think your standards are low. I just think you're open-minded.
I like that.
You know, you're open-minded.
No, there's nothing wrong with Moonraker as an entertaining movie. It is, however, possibly tonally... maybe a little wackadoodle out there compared with, like, you know, compare it with 4 Years Old.
Oh, no, I know what you mean. Yeah.
And again, we're back to the idea that we're flipping back and forth.
And I still think
holes.
It's a, okay, I still think it's a better overall James Bond movie in terms of execution and all the connecting bits.
The Man with the Golden Gun.
The Man with the Golden Gun is. So I'm not trying to crap all over Moonraker.
I'm very much looking forward to Spy Who Loved Me, though, because
that's
supposed to be one of the greats.
And that one kind of does hit.
I've seen it on TV, but it's been a long time. And
that one, I think, does kind of for the Roger Moore movies. That one, okay, they went big, but they didn't go completely bonkers like they did in Moonraker. But I mean, you still have
Moonraker was one of those wake of Star Wars, we got to go into space with ray guns.
And the other bit, which is fine with me.
I was a kid in the late 70s, as were we all, and that was my jam.
And the other nice thing I like about it is
I wanted to see it.
The one other thing I like about, you know, is, okay, it's very much, okay, this is, by golly, Cold War plot. We have the Ruskies, but it kind of gets back to Fleming's idea of you've got Spectre or some other third party that's really who the Reds and the free world need to team up to deal with.
Before that late 80s period where every other movie was about, and now the U.S. and the Soviets must team up to do something.
That was the thing with Spectre. That was where they were trying, you know, that was...
Right, they were the third party.
There's a lesson there somewhere, and they're like, you know, if you spend too much time focusing on it's all them, you aren't going to notice the other guy basically walking up behind you, picking your pocket. There's a lesson there, and Ian Fleming was many things, mean to his liver, but he was not naive.
He was mean to his liver, and he was careless of his arteries.
But he was not naive.
So basically, he lived and ate and drank and smoked the way James Bond is supposed to.
Yeah, and it killed him dead. Killed him dead.
Well, people have calculated that it would have killed Bond much sooner, apparently. Like, if you look at the number of drinks he has and the number of cigarettes he smokes.
Cigarettes, drinks, loose women, food. Yeah, Bond's a dead man walking. Always was. Now, weirdly, I'm going to tell a tale out of school here. It might be out of school. I don't know if she would care. Our mutual friend Susan, back in the 90s, was working on some Bond fan fiction. She always thought that this movie kind of, when like Christopher Lee gets shot dead in the end and he looks kind of disappointed. She's a big Christopher Lee person anyway, old Hammer horror fan. And I think she was working on a fanfic back in the day about Siete Scaramanga. Like Scaramanga had children, and Siete, the Spanish word for seven, I think, would have been like his seventh child, his daughter. And like Scaramanga's daughter coming back to look for revenge on Bond.
Ooh.
If you're listening, and if you remember that story or still have it somewhere, we would certainly all love to read it. And I hope I'm not embarrassing you terribly by putting this in the podcast. I don't think so. But anyway, here at the end of The Man with the Golden Gun, we're kind of at the end of an era. Harry Saltzman sold off his interest. We can get probably more into the backstory with Spy Who Loved Me, but clearly Albert R. Broccoli, if he intends to keep making Bond movies, he's got a chore ahead of him.
They need to do something differently. I mean, there's evidence by this. They kind of owe something differently. United Artists is not the answer. United Artists is going to bring its own set of headaches to things. But I think even if that hadn't have happened, Cubby would have realized we need to do something different here if we're going to keep doing this, or we're not going to keep doing it. And what we got was The Spy Who Loved Me, which is
a landmark of film, period. It's a great, great, great movie. Yeah. And Roger Moore, for going from this to being Roger Moore, frankly, at his absolute best. So that is, thank God, about it for Man with the Golden Gun. We enjoy doing the podcast. I'm just sad we'd be done with this movie.
Well, to quote David Gerald, I'm talking about Star Trek. You know, when I'm saying something critical about Star Trek, I'm sorry to paraphrase, David Gerald. I'm saying something critical about Star Trek. It's not because I don't love Star Trek. Your mother loves you. Your mother's going to tell you, don't put beans up your nose.
Exactly.
Remember, if you're writing a James Bond movie, don't put beans up your nose.
Don't put beans up your nose. Words to live by, friends. I have been your co-host, Eric, a.k.a. Grumpy Number 6, available at number 6, all letters, all lowercase, number 6, at agentsof.cool.
Ray, at agentsof.cool.
Mrs. Peel, MRSPEEL, no period, at agentsof.cool.
As always, we encourage your emails. We would love to get some emails from you if you have questions, if you have show topics you'd like us to cover, recipes for fried mushrooms, if you happen to be a Cordon Bleu chef. Please share these things with us. We have been building up for a little while to getting to The Prisoner. I think we're probably looking at The Prisoner next, and then we'll be back with Spy Who Loved Me before long. So thank you for listening. You know, as always, we love the material. We love doing the show for you, and we'll talk to you soon.
I am Christopher Lee. I have three nippers and a golden gun.